is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, December 9th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and back in Bristol is Troy Farkas. Troy, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Buster. I am ready for the winter meetings because I know our Texas Rangers are going to make some big signings here.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Texas Rangers today. I got questions for Sarah Langs about how good they could be. I got a question for Jesse Rogers about the deals that the Chicago Cubs are talking about. We're going to be talking with Aldin Gonzalez about the Dodgers and the Angels and Garrett Cole and Steven Strasburg and how that all fits together. Some notes as we go into today's podcast. Mark Lerner, one of the Nationals owners, came out and told NBC Sports Washington that the Nationals will not be able to afford both Anthony Rendon and Steven Strasburg, who are, of course, two of the premier free agents on the market this winter. The other day, the Padres made a deal for the Rays, Tommy Pham, picking up Hunter Renfroe, and also there's a swap of minor leaguers. People I talked to absolutely love this deal for Tampa Bay in terms of value they got back. The New York Mets announced the other day that the Wilpon family is negotiating to sell controlling stake in the Mets to hedge fund manager Steve Cohen. That is had a lot of ripple effects around baseball. We'll be talking with Sarah about that. And the other day, the Braves signed left-hander Cole Hamels to a one-year, $18 million deal. And we got word on Sunday night, the two newest Hall of Famers, former labor leader Marvin Miller and longtime catcher Ted Simmons. Let's get to it.
Seamheads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirchen on Baseball Tonight.
And Tim Kirchen covers baseball for ESPN, and he has for a long time. And Tim, I think you and I have been on the same page wondering for years when it would be that Marvin Miller would be honored and inducted into the Hall of Fame. And that day has arrived. What were your feelings when you heard the news?
Well, it should have happened 20 years ago, Buster, that Marvin Miller went into the Hall of Fame. If the Hall of Fame is indeed a museum that chronicles the history of baseball, which it is, then Marvin Miller has to be in. He's one of the most influential people in the history of the game. He's not there with Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey and Babe Ruth, but he's in that similar conversation because of what he has done to the salary structure in Major League Baseball. 1966, the average salary of a Major League player was $19,000. That's when Marvin Miller took over. The minimum was $6,000 for a player, and now look at where salaries have gone. But it's not just that he raised the salaries for players. He did so much more to influence the game today by challenging the reserve clause with the help of Curt Flood and Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally and others. But he changed the way that baseball, the business of baseball, is done, and therefore he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. He should have been in the Hall of Fame 20 years ago.
The interesting thing about him is, Tim, is that my sense is, and I never really got to know him at all, but my sense is, and all that I've read about him and all I heard from players who actually did know him, was that it wasn't like he was someone who was a baseball fan who was looking for the best in baseball. He was a lawyer who was representing his clients, and it turned out that a lot of what he advocated for really helped the game. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he came from, I believe, the steel industry, and
yep,
he was a labor lawyer, and he took on a new case, which was Major League Baseball. I got to know him a little bit in 1981 when I covered that strike, and he screamed at me right in my face a couple times, which I deserved, by the way. I was like 14 years old. I didn't know what I was doing. Not the point. The point is he took on a case, and he was the strongest man in that. He was just not going to bend when he was going to take care of his people, and that's why the game got better because of him. And he did many things to help the players and to help the game, which is remarkable for a guy who, you know, didn't grow up in the game, loving the game, but he still affected the game in many, many positive ways.
All right. Tell me why he yelled at you.
Well, I asked a stupid question, I'm sure, because I just didn't understand what I was talking about. I was too young. It was my first labor negotiation. I didn't understand the, you know, the verbiage of how to talk to a labor lawyer. I could talk to an outfielder, not a lawyer, very well back then. And I asked a stupid question, and he basically yelled at me and told me it was a stupid question, and he was right.
So just spinning this forward a little bit, or using his experience and put it into the current context, it's interesting because in conversations I've had with players in recent weeks and in the last couple of years, I've said to them, look, if you go back and you read John Helliar's book, Lords of the Realm, if you talk to the former players, one thing that Marvin Miller was really, really good at was, I think, getting players to understand why some of the things that they were doing were important and getting the players invested in the process and getting the players together. Because my observation to players, current players, has been, I don't know if you guys necessarily have that. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the issues that we have right now, Buster, as you know, is that a lot of these players, current players, have never been through a labor negotiation. They simply don't know how this works, and it's not their fault because they've never been a part of the process because, thank goodness, we've had labor peace for almost 20 years. So they don't know about Marvin Miller and the people that came before and after him. They don't know what players went through during a strike, a work stoppage. And that's part of the issue that we have now as we look forward a couple years. How are these players going to deal with something that they don't know anything about? And that's what Marvin Miller was so good at doing, was explaining, this is why we're doing this. And let me show you why we have to do this. And this is what the union is now going to have to educate the players to now. And they could really use some help from Marvin Miller because, again, he explained it all so very well.
Ted Simmons was on the writer's ballot just 1 year in 1994. He got 3.7% of the votes, which meant that he got fewer than 5% required to stay on the ballot. He fell off. And yesterday, he got the phone call that he's going to the Hall of Fame as voted on by the special committee. What did you think about him going in?
Well, I think he's a Hall of Famer. I've been on these committees before, as I've told you, Buster, and it's a tremendous privilege to serve on those committees. It's also a really difficult job. And I believe the first time I did the committee, Ted Simmons was on the list, and I'm not rooting or voting for anyone. I'm just trying to present the facts correctly. And I think I presented pretty well that Ted Simmons should be in the Hall of Fame. That was 5 years ago, and now he is. When you look, Buster, when he retired, he had the most hits and most doubles of any catcher ever. Guys who caught 70% of their at-bats came as a catcher. He had more 75 RBI seasons at that time than any catcher in history. I grew up watching him play. He's one of the great hitting catchers I've ever seen, and I think it took too long to get him in. But, Buster, the bigger point here is he should not have been kicked off the ballot after 1 year. There just wasn't enough room for him. And this is another plea by me to say we should be able to vote for as many guys on that ballot as we want in order to give the Bobby Griches, Lou Whitakers, Ted Simmons, another look other than 1 year on the ballot. But sometimes there are 10 guys on the ballot better than you, and you're still a Hall of Famer like Ted Simmons. That's the tricky part for me, and that's where I think a Hall of Fame should look into this a little closer, that maybe we should allow these guys to vote for more than 10 people if they feel there are more than 10 guys eligible for the Hall of Fame.
We got about 2 minutes left. I wrote a column yesterday about Harold Baines and how his induction, without a doubt, is going to change how some candidates are looked at because of where Harold was with his production, his career, and where some of the candidates are. And you mentioned that, you know, you've been on these special committees in the past. I got to tell you, Tim, based on the precedents that the voters on those committees would have to look at, I think this might be one of the most thankless jobs ever at this point, because it's hard to find consistent strain. And that, to me, as a voter, when I used to vote for Hall of Fame stuff, That to me was always the thing I was looking for. Now it's really difficult.
Yeah, I again, it's a privilege. It's an honor. I've been asked to serve four different times, but I'm wondering if I should be doing this again because it is so difficult and it puts me in a difficult situation sometimes as a writer, reporter, journalist who is sworn to secrecy as I should be in one of those meetings. And yet I'm in the business of asking questions and people asking me and I'm not allowed to speak about something. That's the way it should be, but it is such a difficult process. And being in that room, I could write a book about being in that room four different times, but I'm not allowed to, and I'm not going to. But I can promise you, no matter how hard you think it is outside the room, it's harder inside the room.
Yeah, I think it's great Ted Simmons getting the Hall of Fame. I think it was great last year when Harold got in. But when you look at the production for, you know, other candidates who were looked at yesterday or over the weekend, Dwight Evans and Dale Murphy and Lou Whitaker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think it's getting more and more difficult to figure out, okay, who is a Hall of Famer and who's not. All right, Tim, thanks for doing this.
Okay, Buster, talk to you soon.
Numbers game.
Sarah Lang is a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And, Sarah, we got the news last week that your team, the Mets, will be undergoing an ownership change over the next 5 years. They are working in agreement with Steve Cohen to take over as the owner of the team, and according to the agreement, for over the next 5 years, Fred and Jeff Wilpon will continue to be in the club's hierarchy and be involved in the decisions. But I haven't spoken to anybody who actually thinks that that would be the case. Typically, the person who's buying the team takes control earlier. As a Mets fan, what was your reaction to this news?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that this is something that fans certainly have been pretty vocal about wanting to see for a while. So from that perspective, it seems like a good thing. You never know exactly what's going to happen. I know that these sales don't happen just overnight, but the 5 years, what you were talking about does seem interesting. You know, we'll see exactly what happened. I agree with you that I know that everything was reported that it would be the Wilpons would still be involved, but I just can't imagine spending all that money on a team and not wanting to, and not making a case to be part of the decision making from the get go, you know, from Cohen's perspective. You know, we've seen this team not necessarily compete, with the Yankees in terms of going after free agents and the market that they're in for a long time now. So it would certainly be something I think that fans would want to see, for them to be operating like a big market team in New York.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely a game changer. You know, he would become, according to reports, the wealthiest owner in baseball. And look, even if for the moment he's standing on the side politely, if in the fall of 2020 or 2021, you know, somebody like a Mookie Betts or Francisco Lindor 3 years from now, Aaron Judge was in the free agent market, and this was a player he wanted, he'd essentially be adding to his own bill. It would be on his own dime. So even if he had the Wilpons running the day-to-day operations, he would be able to influence by simply stepping in and said, hey, that's what I want to do. I think everybody in baseball is sort of curious about what this means for Brody Van Wagenen, their general manager. But the fact is that if you're a Mets fan, you probably are going to be able to dream in a way that they really haven't, with very few exceptions, Carlos Beltran signing being one. They've never really been involved with the highest priced guy in the marketplace.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I just think that that's what, you know, you see a team from New York and you expect them to, right? Just at face value, not knowing much about the franchises, just kind of knowing how sports work in markets and cities in this country. So it would certainly be, you know, refreshing in a way to see them choose to and be able to compete in that market. And I don't know if you saw this from Tim Britton of The Athletic, but you know, there were a lot of people sort of digging into Cohen as a big art collector and the money he spent there. And I don't know if you saw this nugget that he once spent $141.3 million on a statue called The Pointing Man, which is more than the Mets have ever spent committed to any player on a contract. So I very much enjoyed that. That's very much up my alley, as you would imagine.
Now, when Frank McCourt was owner of the Dodgers, you'd hear from people with Major League Baseball some frustration because they felt like, boy, the Los Angeles Dodgers are one of the signature franchises for baseball. But at that time, their payroll was in the, you know, $80 million range. and the full power of the franchise wasn't really being exploited by Frank McCourt. But then he was forced out of ownership by Major League Baseball. He sells to the Guggenheim Foundation. And since then, the Dodgers have become exactly what baseball needs them to be. And they've won the division the last 7 years. Andrew Friedman's front office is considered to be a model of how you run a big market team. So we've seen that potential unlocked in the Dodgers case, and I think there's a good chance we're going to see that happen in the Mets case. All right, let's take a look at some of the storylines that are developing during the course this winter. One of the interesting decisions made, I think, has been by the Texas Rangers to build their rotation as they go move into their new ballpark next spring around these mid-level signings. They're not really involved, as far as we know, in Gerrit Cole or Steven Strasburg. But after signing Lance Lynn to a 3-year, $30 million deal last winter and signing Mike Minor, this winter you saw him go out, sign Kyle Gibson, sign Jordan Lyles to a deal that, you know, both those deals in the mid-level range. How close do you think they are to contending?
I don't know about close to contending, only because they're in such a tough division there, you know, with the Astros, who are, you know, a perennial playoff team at this point, and the A's, who have shown how competitive they can be, especially over these last 2-3 years. But I do think that they're taking, I obviously every team would like to have Steven Strasburg and Gerrit Cole, but I think that they're taking a good approach. I mean, beyond signing one of those guys, because their rotation beyond Mike Minor and Lance Lynn was so bad last year. All their other starters combined for a 7.22 ERA. I mean, they are pretty much in the situation where any arm that can keep an ERA going under about 4.5 is worthwhile. You know, so I'm glad to see them addressing the rotation. And I think that, you know, one interesting thing is whether addressing the rotation in this way shows that maybe they are very serious about Anthony Rendon, that they might try to sign someone else, a Donaldson or someone else like that, if they aren't able to get him. Because it does seem like they are trying to improve, even if we don't see them with the absolute biggest, you know, pitching name out there.
And I've heard rival executives say privately they think that they will be the favorites to sign Anthony Rendon. 2 minutes, two quick ones for you. How close do you think the White Sox are to contending?
You know, I would, if they won the division this year, like, we wouldn't be expecting it, all of that, but I wouldn't be completely surprised, because the Indians are tending towards being very not competitive, right? They could trade Francisco Lindor, and even if they don't, I mean, we saw what happened this year, and there are many ways that they could end up being worse this coming year in 2020. And the Twins are going to regress. You can't have that kind of offensive season in 2 straight years. Their pitching fell apart a bit in the second half. Resigning Jake Odorizzi, or I'm sorry, him taking the qualifying offer was a good thing, but I don't think that's quite enough. So I think they could. I mean, I think they certainly have the most promise in the division. And Yasmani Grandal makes every pitcher better. And he's a great offensive catcher. So I'm very high on the White Sox. I think realistically, it's not this year. Maybe it's next year, 2021. But I would believe it this year.
A lot of pressure being piled on the Yankees, I think, at this point to sign Gerrit Cole. And there's no doubt. I mean, he would be absolutely perfect for them. And, you know, their ownership wants him. But I still think that they would be fine. Not necessarily, you know, it wouldn't be an optimal situation if they didn't sign him. But they would be okay. Because as one executive said to me, it's not like they don't have any other starters. Luis Severino, you know, who didn't pitch that much last year, finished third in the Cy Young Award voting a couple of years ago. And you have Masahiro Tanaka. You have James Paxton. It's not like they have an empty cupboard.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they're losing a certain amount of innings in Domingo Herman. Likely, we don't know exactly what's going to happen there with CeCe Sabathia retiring and with Jay Happ likely not re-signing. But those guys weren't their heaviest, you know, quantity of innings this year. I think that you can definitely put together a case that Paxton will improve in year two, that year one was sort of figuring it out, you know, coming into his own on a new team. And Masahiro Tanaka is such a, like, tried and true stalwart at this point in that rotation for them. And, you know, the thing I was looking at is that, you know, Davey Garcia is still pretty far away, probably a September guy, maybe a desperation July move, but I do think they're fine. And I mean, this team was 15th in the majors in starters ERA last year, and look how far they went. You know, they're going to have a great offense again. We know that. And it was able to carry them, and it didn't end up mattering a whole lot until the playoffs, right? Obviously, the goal is a World Series, so you need to fix it for that point. But I certainly think that if they were not to sign either of them, they would be at least fine like they were this year.
All right, Sarah. Well, good to talk with you. Have fun watching the winter meetings.
Thanks so much, Buster. Good to talk with you.
Ali Gonzalez covers the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Angels of Anaheim for ESPN. And first off, and also, I guess, the San Diego Padres this winter, since they're one of the more aggressive teams. So tell me, you know, the Angels are involved in Gerrit Cole. The Dodgers are involved in Gerrit Cole and Anthony Rendon. Anything that you've heard recently, anything that's jumped out at you about what's taken place with the big dogs in the free agent market?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things for both teams. I mean, you've spoken a lot about this, Buster, and we all know that the Dodgers are very hesitant to do these big long-term deals for free agents, particularly for pitchers. I still think that between these two teams, the team to watch for Gerrit Cole is going to be the Angels. We've seen this before with Artie Moreno and big free agents. When he sees somebody that he's targeting, that he's zeroing in on, he's usually pretty intent about chasing that player. What I've heard about the Angels' interest in Gerrit Cole is that Artie Moreno's not the type to be outbid when he wants somebody as desperately as he seems to want Gerrit Cole. And I think that it's just going to be fascinating to see how it plays out with them. I think the worst thing that could have happened for the Angels in this scenario was that the Yankees seemed very intent on getting Gerrit Cole. And if they're going to pay a premium as well, that's going to be a tough thing for them to overcome, even knowing that Gerrit Cole is from the area. And, you know, with the Dodgers, I feel like I say this every year with them this time of year, but they could do everything and nothing, and I wouldn't be surprised by either outcome. They have so much roster flexibility. They actually, Andrew Freeman has gotten them to the point with their payroll where they have some payroll flexibility coming up. So I feel like if there was ever a time for them to kind of make a splash and sort of go against Andrew's methodology with these free agents, this would be the off season. I think the interesting thing with the Dodgers is that given the talent on their roster, they're only chasing the high end players. Only the high end players will sort of constitute an upgrade for them, and that's why you get into the Anthony Rendon and the Gerrit Cole and the Francisco Lindor via trade. I think Rendon is the very appealing one to them just because if he's willing to take a short-term high AAV deal similar to the one that they offered Bryce Harper last year, that's going to be appealing to them. It's not a natural fit because he plays third base and they have Justin Turner, but they could easily move guys around and make that work.
Yeah, it's interesting because every winter, I mean, I remember when Giancarlo Stanton was available with the Marlins, and last winter is Bryce Harper. You know, this winter it's Gerrit Cole and it's Steven Strasburg and Anthony Rendon. We talk about how, and you're exactly right, you know, the Dodgers, while they've been continued to win, they've also been excellent at player development, excellent at payroll management. They could step out and spend a lot of money, but I once joked with Andrew Friedman when he was running the Rays that he would be the guy who would go into a casino to play blackjack and he would never deviate from his system. Right? He would have his point total and when he would fold and when he would hit and that sort of thing. And he would never deviate from it. And I still think in the end, that's what happens here, that he's going to have his very defined price, which is going to be less than what those guys can get someplace else. And then it comes down to whether or not a Gerrit Cole or Rendon wants to play for them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm sure he loved hearing that from you, by the way, Buster, that he would never deviate from his plan. you know, and I think one mistake that we make with the Dodgers often, and, you know, one counter that Andrew Friedman would make to what the narrative has been with the Dodgers is he'll say, well, you know, it's a results-based narrative because we've actually chased a lot of players and we've made big offers to free agents and big offers via trade and they just haven't been accepted. And I think that's fair, but I think one mistake that we always make with the Dodgers is that we always go the simple route with them, which is sign a free agent, plug him in here. And that's not necessarily the way they think. I think it's always more appealing to them, actually, to go the trade route because they have so much in their system. They have so much depth on their 40-man roster. And if they could acquire a player who, yeah, they're going to have to give up some prospects, but one thing that they have shown under Andrew Friedman is they are not afraid to give up prospects to get guys that they need via trade. If they could get a guy on the trade market who's still in his arbitration years, who's still in his mid-20s, I think that's the more appealing route. So when you're thinking about upgrades to the position player group or to the, maybe even the starting rotation or the bullpen, I think that always is the more likely scenario for them. Rather than chase a free agent who's nearing 30 and is going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, if they could trade for a guy in his arbitration years, that's the more interesting. That's the more likely route for them. They can get very creative, and I could see them getting very creative. I think one thing that's fair to say is I think this might be an off season where they maybe look to shake things up a little bit. You know, a team that went to back to back World Series and then all of a sudden gets knocked out in the first round. Maybe you do something to jolt that group. Maybe you do something to sort of change up the dynamics in there somehow. And I'm going to be really interested in seeing how they go about it.
Along those lines, I do think that Jock Peterson's going to get traded this winter. You know, he's getting to the point where he's starting to get expensive, and his value has reached its tipping point, trade value, and I think they'll flip him. Back to the Angels real quickly. If they don't sign Gerrit Cole, my guess is that Hyunjin Ryu becomes a real target for them. What's your sense of what their safety nets are if they don't get Cole?
Yeah, Hyunjin Ryu could be a target for them. Steven Strasburg would be a guy that they would love to chase after. I mean, he'd be the next guy in line. They could give him a similar offer. I think they're in pretty dire straits, though, if they don't get Gerrit Cole. And it's rare to ever say this, where a team needs a certain player or else. But given where they are right now, they really want to compete. They haven't had an ace at the top of their rotation in, I want to say, at least like 6 years. And there's not really another player out there besides Gerrit Cole and Steven Strasburg that could be the difference maker in their rotation that they need to make up what was basically a 20 to 30 win gap with the Astros. They're not going to be able to access that player via trade unless they give up Joe Adele. They're not giving up Joe Adele. So it's basically Gerrit Cole or Steven Strasburg, or they're going to field just sort of an average to slightly above average or even below average rotation next year, and they're probably not going to be good enough in that division. That's just basically where they are. It's very simple, and you could have telegraphed this months ago with the Angels that, okay, they're going to try to win next year. They better get Gerrit Cole, otherwise I don't see a path to contention in that division for them.
And before we go, I want to ask you about the Padres, who've been one of the more aggressive teams early in this winter's market after Ron Fowler came out. Who's one of the, I think he's the CEO of the team, is his title, basically came out and said, we have to win next year or else heads are going to roll, including mine. You saw them spend $34 million on Drew Pomerantz, a reliever, early in the offseason. They traded the other day for Tommy Pham to upgrade their roster. People that I've spoken with other teams love that trade for Tampa Bay in the flip of the prospects and Tampa Bay getting the younger player, Hunter Renfro. You mentioned the gap that the Angels had with the Astros. This is why I've been surprised that the Padres, who have one of baseball's best farm systems and clearly are making progress and might be, I think, 2 or 3 years away from contending, they finished 36 games behind the Dodgers last year. And the idea that, you know, with a series of moves this winter that they could seriously compete with L.A., I think it's dangerous. I think it's a dangerous game to play and might wind up undercutting a lot of the work they've done. What do you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, I really love the Tommy Pham deal. Just getting that type of guy in their outfield and also that type of guy in their clubhouse, that's a great deal for them. But they're operating under disillusionment, and that's how you make bad decisions. They're not close to winning. They were on a path toward, because they exercised prudence and patience, they put themselves on a path where they could maybe win in 2 to 3 years. But when you, all of a sudden you start thinking that you're ready to win now and you start trying to make these win now moves to catch up with a team that you are very far away from in the Dodgers, that's how you make bad decisions. That's how you set yourself back. That's how you rush prospects who maybe are not ready. They have so, as you know, they have so much great starting pitching, so many great starting pitching prospects in their farm system who are in the lower to mid levels, though, and who are not ready to be in a big league rotation. And to force those guys or to clog up your payroll because you're under this illusion that you could win now, I think that's very dangerous. And I think A.J. Preller has a really fascinating tightrope to walk this offseason. I mean, one of the motivations for signing a guy like Manny Machado last year was that, okay, yeah, we're spending big on a free agent maybe a little bit before our window is open, but he is a 26-year-old free agent, and he could still be in his prime when we're ready to contend. I don't think that window is now. I mean, they have some nice pieces. They got nothing from their catchers last year, and I don't know how they're going to get any production there. Their outfield is still a little bit of a mess. It's still a little bit unproven, even with Tommy Pham. And there's still a lot to be said about their starting pitching because it's so exceedingly young. So I don't think they're ready now, and I agree with you. I think it's dangerous to sort of push your chips to the middle of the table when you're just not ready yet.
Yeah, you don't have the cards yet. I have heard from other teams they like their acquisition of Grisham and of Jurickson Profar to play second base because the Padres last year were so right-handed, and they were 29th out of 30 teams in terms of platoon advantage at bats. In other words, a right-handed hitter versus a left-handed pitcher or a left-handed hitter versus a right-handed pitcher, 29th out of 30 teams in percentage of that, and this should help getting those two guys. All right, sir, I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Buster. Appreciate it.
Jesse Rogers covers Chicago Cubs, Chicago White Sox for ESPN at the winter meetings. And, Jesse, I've had a lot of conversations with executives with other teams. And look, you and I, you know, talked last winter about how the Cubs are willing to listen on about Chris Bryant at that time. This winter, it's interesting. What I'm hearing a lot from other teams is that they really feel like that the Cubs, in their effort to get better, in an effort to get ahead of some of the payroll issues that they're dealing, they're open to the idea of a conversation about catcher Wilson Contreras, which was the most surprising development of this winter for me. What do you hear?
Yeah, oh no, I've heard similar, and I heard that early on in the offseason. He's 1 year behind guys like Chris Bryant and Kyle Schwarber on the arbitration, you know, timeline here. So he'll be a free agent after three more seasons. He's making very little. He's very attractive. The Cubs have a payroll dilemma currently and potentially in the near future if they don't make some moves. I don't think it's very often, Buster, you have four or five star type players all on the same path time-wise. You know, they're all going to be free agents in 2 years. I'm talking about Bryant, Schwarber, Baez, Rizzo. There's some other guys, Almora. Contreras is behind them, but he's very attractive because of all those things. And the point is this, they have to move basically two of those guys. And I do think Bryant on one end of the scale is, you know, as a marquee name, is one guy, and Contreras sort of on the other end, still a big name, but doesn't make as much and has 3 years to go. I mean, those are the two guys that can bring back the most. I don't think you can get the haul you'd want from Kyle Schwarber or, you know, by his different category. I think he's kind of going to be the face of the franchise. If he isn't already, they'll probably lock him up. So I think that's where you're hearing that stuff. And frankly, there's some warts to Contreras' game that maybe other teams don't see as much as the Cubs.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that when I first heard his name mentioned, I go, huh, because I knew that when he was promoted to the big leagues, one thing I constantly heard from Cubs people is, we love his energy, we love his energy, we love his energy. Then when you'd watch the games, there were times when you wondered if the energy was, you know, for some veteran pitchers, may have been a little bit too much, that there was too much peaks and valleys in some of his games. But because he hasn't really made big money yet, he's going to presumably be attractive to other teams. What teams potentially could you see him being a fit with?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to speculate too much on that one because I don't know. And the reason I say that is, unlike Chris Bryant, who's very attractive to several contending type teams, his market, meaning Contreras, is pretty wide open. If you think about a rebuilding team, wouldn't mind a catcher for 3 years, that right-handed power-hitting catcher. You get at least 3 years out of him. And here's a guy that's made no money in this game. You'd probably be able to lock up Wilson Contreras at a pretty friendly deal in the next year or two. He's made nothing. He wasn't a high draft pick. He hasn't made anything yet through arbitration. So that's where, I mean, there's a lot of fits. There's a lot of fits for him. I don't know about, you know, the team that is about to win a World Series. Adding a catcher like that is great, but he's got some framing issues. He's got those issues with, you know, if your starting catcher isn't getting along with your staff and a World Series contender, you got a big problem right off the bat. So I almost feel like he's a better fit for a team coming out of a rebuild or even in a rebuild. I'm not saying contenders won't be interested, but I just think that there's a lot of different layers to Wilson Contreras that makes him attractive, but also a little worrisome for some of those contending teams. And that's why I think even a team coming out of rebuild is a possibility for him.
Now, you mentioned Chris Bryant. There's a really interesting game of musical chairs going on in the third base market. You've got Anthony Rendon out there, who's the best position player free agent on the marketplace. And a lot of executives believe that he's going to wind up with either the Texas Rangers, the most likely team, or perhaps the Los Angeles Dodgers. You have the Atlanta Braves, who are looking for a third baseman. You have Josh Donaldson out there. You also have the Philadelphia Phillies, who are in the marketplace looking at third baseman. And last winter, when we began this conversation about Chris Bryant, all along I've thought, boy, the Phillies make a lot of sense for him. Boy, they signed Jake Arrieta, a Scott Boras client, who represents also Chris Bryant. He also represents Bryce Harper, who just signed with the Phillies. Bryant and Harper grew up in Las Vegas, so you know behind the scenes that Bryce Harper would be calling his good friend John Middleton, the CEO of the Phillies, saying, let's go out and get Chris Bryant. It just seems to make too much sense to me. What about to you?
I would look at the team down the road that just signed Cole Hamels. I really like the idea of Chris Bryant to the Braves over the Phillies, and I'll tell you why. The Phillies are not sending back Aaron Nola, obviously. The Braves have young, major league-ready starting pitchers. They also have a couple prospects, but a Max Fried, a Fulton Ivitz. There's guys there. I don't think they trade Soroka, but there's guys
Kyle
there.
Wright. Kyle Wright, one of their top young arms.
There's another, Ian Anderson. There's guys that are major league ready, and the Cubs feel like they're not taking a huge risk, right, if you trade for Fried. Well, he's already proven himself at the major league level. So you get him back, and you get a couple arms in terms of prospects. I don't know if the Phillies can do exactly the same. They might be able to do the same from the prospect side of things. You could just add a third, a fourth, you could get there. But is there anybody like a Max Fried or even Fulton Ivitz? He fixed his game in the second half that the Phillies could send back. I don't know. So I feel like the Braves are a better fit. And here's the thing. You're so right about the third base market. I think if you're a team, you have to think of Chris Bryant as a free agent. You're going to sign to a 2-year contract. Because he is a free agent in 2 years. And then you have to compare that to Arenado and these other guys. Chris Bryant comes very affordable for 2 years. I mean, it's going to be $45-50 million through arbitration, but that's not so bad when you think of the alternatives, which is probably obviously Rendon for huge, even Donaldson. I'll tell you, the Cubs' advantage is the fact that Donaldson already did his 1-year rebuild his reputation contract. He doesn't want to do that again. So the teams that don't want to get involved in any 3-, 4-, 5-year deals for Rendon or even Donaldson, that's where you turn to Bryant. Say 2 years, 45, 50, that's a good deal. And that's why it's a contending team. Don't count out the Dodgers. The Dodgers are going to be a sneaky team this offseason, I think. Everybody thinks they're all set. No, you finally lost in the first round there, and now the halo's off a little bit. You might need to switch things up, and I think they're going to. So I think the Bryant sweepstakes are very interesting because think about a 2-year signing of Chris Bryant for under $50 million. Who wouldn't take that? And that's essentially how you have to think about it.
All right. Before you go, one thing about Bryant, though, is that this grievance he has with the Cubs about his service time and whether or not it was manipulated, that's still pending. How much do you think that'll complicate their efforts to trade him?
Maybe a little bit. I said the other day, I think worst case, Buster, and maybe, you might know this landscape better than me. A deal gets in place and it's not pulled until that decision is made. Alex Anthopoulos or the Phil, Phillies, whoever it is, we've got this thing ready. Let's make sure Chris doesn't win this because nobody really believes they're going to win this grievance, that it was a good, thing for the negotiate, that when the next CBA is up, good negotiating. Hey, look how serious we took this situation, the arbiter and everything. So I don't think it's going to complicate things too much unless the opposing team really thinks he has a chance of winning. Because obviously getting him for 2 years or 1 year instead of 2 years makes a huge difference. So that's my feeling. Like they may get a deal in place and wait for the arbiter to decide. He loses the grievance and then they make the trade.
All right, Jesse. Well, have fun out in San Diego.
Thank you, Buster. Take care.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buster, a couple Bleacher Tweets for the first day of the winter meetings here. First one comes from Trevor Dunning at TL Dunning. Hey, Buster, instead of suspensions or fines, I think the Astros should be ineligible for the 2020 playoffs. What are your thoughts?
Man, Trevor, coming down. Are you talking about the hanging judge? No, you can't do that. That's too steep. I mean, first off, the Players Association would go nuts. All the players in the Astros would go nuts. You know, especially players who weren't involved in any of this stuff that took place, the new guys on the team. So I don't think that's going to happen. I will say this, continue to hear that whenever the decision comes down, it's going to be big time.
I'm wondering what it would take, because I don't think, have we ever seen anything like that at the professional sports level? We've seen it collegially where you have teams ineligible for postseasons, but professionally, I don't know. I don't know what it would take for that to happen.
Right, and the NCAA controls the players in a way that the players aren't controlled in professional sports. So it'll never happen. No, absolutely not.
Exactly. Next one comes from Johnny Capodino at J Super Scout, and I know there's some form of tradition here. I don't know what it is. So anyway, Buster, what is the market for Madison Bumgarner in today's analytics-heavy world?
It's a great question because there's no doubt, and we talked about this during the summertime when his name was popping up in the trade market. There are teams that look at some of his underlying metrics, and they have concerns. But he is who he is. He's been a big star. He's had a lot of success in the postseason. And you do wonder if an owner is going to get really inspired and basically will tell his front office, look, we want Madison Bumgarner to lead our team. I still think there's a chance he winds up with the Phillies.
Thanks for the question, Johnny Super Scout. Love you. Justin Simmons at Justin Lance Sim 1. Hey, Buster, is Alex Anthopoulos the most discreet GM in baseball? I'd heard he likes to work under the radar, and the Cole Hamels signing seemed to come out of nowhere.
Yeah, they had been in the market. I think they've been mentioned as being in the market for a starting pitcher. And essentially what we're seeing with Cole Hamels is that he's going to replace Dallas Keuchel in their rotation. I know this, that Cole Hamels' agent, John Boggs, was basically out there telling teams, look, if some team is willing to give us a deal that's basically the equivalent of the qualifying offer, which is $18 million, we're ready to move. Alex Anthopoulos heard that. He made a move for his starting pitcher that he needs, and he was the first one to sign the best closer in the market, Will Smith. So you're right. Alex has been really aggressive. And by the way, I laughed when you sort of glossed over the Johnny Super Scout. You still don't understand the reference, right?
No idea.
Totally clueless. You're fishing around for the reference a little bit.
No idea what it's about. Anyway, our friend CrossFit School of Sweat at School of Sweat has a bone to pick. What is the point of having so many various ways of getting into the Hall of Fame? It's about the all-time greats. There shouldn't have to be lobbying and waiting for selection. If you are one of the best, everyone knows.
I agree with you, and it's part of the reason why I'm really glad that I'm out of that conversation. You heard Tim talk about the question of whether or not he feels like it's right for him to be on the committee and the complication. Troy, I mean, trying to figure out who's a Hall of Famer now. Wow. You know, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds are not in the Hall of Fame. Other guys who took PEDs are in the Hall of Fame. There are guys who are lesser players who've been left off by the special committee this weekend than maybe some of the guys have gotten in. It makes my brain hurt. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's also been some influence from other sports as well, because I think with basketball, the standards are a lot lower than they have been in the past, and I just think in all sports, really, the standards have been lowered, and we're starting to see that happen with baseball. And then you have these mixing of generations. You have old voters, you have younger voters who all have different beliefs about how to approach the whole system, so it's all over the place.
I would agree with you on that, and I'd say this. We need to remember it's just a baseball museum, right? It's not life and death, but people really care about the Baseball Hall of Fame. All right. My thanks today to Tim, to Sarah, to Alden, to Jesse, to Troy. Troy, you might want to line up Josh Macri so he can, we'll bring him on board and he can explain the whole Johnny Super Scout thing. Does that sound like a good plan?
I don't know. I don't like to talk to Josh Macri. We're kind of sworn enemies. So I try to stay clear of him. Yeah. I mean, he betrayed us. He went on to go be a head honcho at the ACC network. He left us behind, Buster. Why aren't you mad at him?
Can we have like a temporary like armistice between you guys to get him back on the show just to explain the Johnny Super Scout reference?
I suppose we can make it happen this week.
Or sometime in the future, right? You can kick the can down the road. Yeah, we'll try to make that happen so that Troy knows the Johnny Super Scout reference. I know all the longtime listeners do. All right, have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and follow the baseball news as we talk to Tim off air. We got a couple of baseball tonights later today that we're looking forward to. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.